You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. This is the American Hour. Thank you for joining us. And if you've downloaded the show, we want to thank you for doing that also. It's a great way to get caught up on our shows, or if you miss a show and you wanted to listen to it, well, it's not always optimum to be listening to a radio show when the radio show is actually being broadcast, but it does allow you to call in if you had a comment or question or something like that. Well, we got a good show for you today or tonight, depending on where you are. And of course, we are constantly working to expose the lies, the deception, the unconstitutional maneuvering of the liberal left, and particularly this administration, because they've done it at a faster pace, in a bigger way than anybody I've ever seen in my lifetime. So with that all said, you know, I was thinking about something today, Paula, and there's Paula. I should have introduced you right off the bat. Our lovely co-host, Paula Lauzon. How are you today, Paula?
Doing excellent, Tom. How are you? I'm sorry for jumping on so late. I was in the middle of a couple of other things. I was on Bella D'Angelo's show last evening. What an awesome show that was.
Good. Yeah, she called me, and I need to call her back. She asked if I wanted to come on sometime in the next week or two, and absolutely, she does a great show. And if anybody's interested, Bella D'Angelo, who's that? How do I listen to her? Go to our website, usaradionetwork.com. That's usaradionetwork.com, and there's a link to her website where you can, I think, I'm pretty certain you can, like ours, download past shows and see what's coming up and when she's going to be broadcasting, and enjoy her show. She does a great show. So what did you guys talk about?
We discussed, let me bring this up here really quick, you'll have to bear with me, there were a couple of items that were on the agenda. You know, we talked about, you know, the Bakken and the shale and whatnot. And then there was discussion about the declaration that Obumbler and Prime Minister Harper of Canada had signed back in February of 2011. That came up in the discussion. And his signing of the executive orders revising authority to nationalize resources for defense, that was a big issue. That was a big discussion last night as well.
I looked at that, and I'm not really sure if he really gave himself that much power or what he's setting the stage for there. But you're right, it does give the impression that if things get really ugly, he's setting himself up to declare martial law and do what he needs to do, not to save the country, but to take total control of it.
Yep, and I can tell you that everybody around the table last night was not too happy about it. It, you know, in a nutshell, the executive order gives the Homeland Security Secretary authority to issue guidance to other department heads to establish and activate the National Defense Executive Reserve composed of experts in the private and public sector, not full-time federal employees, to fill executive positions in the federal government in the event of a national defense emergency.
Yeah, national defense emergency. Do you think he might be getting ready for the election? And if he sees it coming, that he's going to lose, it's very clear. Do you think there will be a big national emergency? That's what people have predicted. Rush Limbaugh said that a year or two ago. But you watch and see, if it looks like he's struggling in the election, something bad will happen. And then we will have to cancel the elections. You know, I've said it a million times, Paula. If the government gets too much control, and especially with this use of the Commerce Clause, if they can control anything and everything that affects commerce, then they can control voting. They can control elections. They can stop elections. Because the way the Commerce Clause is being interpreted now, and we're going to do a show. I think we'll do that tomorrow night. I'm going to talk some more on the Commerce Clause and the Supreme Court and what is going on with the arguments about it being constitutional, not constitutional, and that kind of thing, and then my own argument. So we'll do that tomorrow night. And I got some interesting stuff and some things that I've been researching that expose why it's clearly unconstitutional and that the Supreme Court has been doing unconstitutional things in their rulings for many, many years. So we'll do that tomorrow night. Tonight I wanted to talk about something. Now, you're in the energy business, Paula. Primarily wind, correct? Or is it any type of sustainable energy that your company deals with?
Any sustainable type of energy.
Okay. Now, you know, there's been problems with solar and the you know, reasons, the excuses are, well, then the Chinese just started pumping out cheap solar panels. Well, they can do that with anything. They can do that with cars and all kinds of other things, and they do that. You know, so what's the response? And did not this administration or anybody see that coming? But the president's gotten a lot of flack for his algae comment. Now, I want you to play the devil's advocate because you know the liberal mind, Paula, and pretend like you're a libtard that called into the show. And I'm going to ask you some questions about algae. Okay? So you're a proponent of the president saying we can get energy out of algae. Now, do you know how we get energy out of algae? Do you just pour a bunch of green algae in your car and it runs? Or you know, some type of new engine? How do we get energy out of algae? And you don't have to know any of these things. You can just you can do a very good job of playing a libtard if you go, I don't know.
To be quite honest with you, I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at it now, and you know, there's a firm out in California that's received more than $25 million in federal grants and contracts as part of Obama's, you know, administration's stimulus package. And, excuse me, it looks like they're poised to receive millions more as part of his recent efforts to promote green biofuels such as algae. I don't know how they're squeezing it out of there because there's a lot of it there.
Well, what they, my understanding, and I read all about it a couple months ago, and I've already forgotten half of what I read, but the bottom line is they're going to create a type of alcohol, type-based product, just like when we make ethanol from corn or sugar cane, et cetera. So it's something that will burn, a liquid that will burn. Now, why are we spending all this money, again, keep your libtard hat on, Paula, why are we spending all this money to create something that will burn when we already have gobs and gobs of stuff that will burn, called oil, once it's refined into gasoline? Why?
I don't have an answer for that. He's claiming it's clean energy. I don't know.
he can say it's clean. It's not clean at all. Anything
you
burn puts carbon into the air. Now, remember, ethanol was supposed to be the solution to cleaner burning fuel. It turns out that ethanol pollutes more than gasoline. So all of the federal requirements to put ethanol in gasoline that we're using daily is polluting more than the gasoline itself. And it's hard to fathom. I've found all this information myself by going to, I think it was maybe the EPA's website, several years ago, and I looked at the comparison of pollutants from ethanol and gasoline and also propane, natural gas, and there were a couple others, diesel. And ethanol in some areas like nitric oxide, nitric acid, and a few other things puts out way more than gasoline. It puts out slightly less CO2, what you and I are exhaling, Paula. It puts out slightly less CO2. The problem is ethanol burns at a much lower temperature, which means you get worse fuel mileage, worse gas mileage. So you have to use more of it to go the same distance. So once you use more of it to go the same distance, although gallon for gallon it burns slightly, and I'm saying slightly less than gasoline, it puts out less CO2. It ultimately puts out more CO2 as well as more other pollutants. And how are we paying for this? ethanol. It's not just the consumer going and buying a gallon of gasoline. It's the taxpayer is subsidizing the corn industry to grow the corn that's being used to produce ethanol. So without the subsidizing, there would be no ethanol in our gasoline because it doesn't pay. We have to spend more money just to create it than it's worth.
Right.
So it has to be subsidized. So what I've been asking some of my libtard so-called friends is, why then are we going to sink billions of dollars into research for so-called algae that we don't know what it's actually going to produce, and we don't know that it's going to be cleaner? You can't just say that here's one of our lies. We talk about trying to catch them in their lies. You cannot claim that it's cleaner. There's no proof at this point yet that the byproduct of using algae to produce a fuel is cleaner than gasoline. So it's not cleaner. And it will pollute, just like gasoline, because it's going to be burned in automobiles, which if you have an engineering degree, you've probably taken a thermodynamics class like I did in college, and you will know that the gasoline engine is the most inefficient engine ever designed of all types of engines, whether it be a jet engine in an airplane, a diesel motor, all kinds of other engines that exist, locomotive engine, steam engine. The gasoline is the most inefficient. Now, they're a lot more efficient than they used to be compared to back when we had carburetors on cars. But
I
still extremely
saw a really good article that came out today by Thomas Lifson on An American Thinker, and it's called Crony Capitalism and Algae Energy. It's a really good piece.
Yes, and in fact, that was one of the articles that I looked at and tweeted about, and it really highlights. In fact, it's similar to an article or something that I did last week where I talked about who's behind these companies that have been getting the green funding and then going bankrupt, et cetera. But, I do remember seeing that this morning. Maybe
yep.
We'll talk about that some more tomorrow night. But I thought it was interesting to kind of contemplate, why are we spending all this money to create something that we already have? Now, the only possible answer a libtard can give us, because they can't claim it's cleaner burning, they can't claim it'll be cheap. The only thing they can claim is that we can produce it ourselves and be self-sufficient. Well, we can also be self-sufficient if we drill our own oil. But does anybody out there know how much algae it takes? And I read a couple articles on it, but how much algae it takes to produce enough oil to, say, even power the cars in any given small town? Oh, it's miles of bogs, of algae swamp to cultivate it. It's just like having to grow corn, you know, for ethanol. To actually be completely dependent, you would need a huge amount of territory. And where's that likely to happen in the U.S.? Well, it's not. If the technology is even viable, it's going to happen in another country, like Brazil or Mexico, that has a lot of land that's just not being used and might have the right climate for that purpose. So guess what? We won't be energy independent. We'll be out buying all of our algae fuel from another country. So that just defeats the whole purpose. It's like all these cars, the electric cars. All of the lithium in these batteries comes from Bolivia. So if we were all suddenly magically driving electric cars, we would all be dependent on Bolivia, our cars. And these batteries that we're putting in, the lithium batteries we're putting in the cars, are not cheap. They're quite expensive. You don't just run to Walmart and pick up a new battery for your car. It's a series of batteries. And they have to be replaced about every 10 years or so, pretty close to about every 10 years. So replacing those batteries is almost like buying a new car. What happens if Bolivia decides to embargo lithium coming to the U.S. for making batteries? Or stops, or maybe they're making the batteries down there and they decide to not sell them to us, just like the Arabs, you know, in the 70s embargoed oil coming to the U.S. Then we're dependent on it. See how we're dependent on somebody else? We cannot possibly produce enough algae fuel in this country to drive 150 million cars. Now, the libtard will tell you that, well, we just need to get rid of cars. Oh, beautiful. Yeah, that's great. Let's live like medieval times. And I guess we'll all, you know, try and find a horse or a mule or just start walking everywhere. And that's really what they want. They would like us to create, whenever you hear the word sustainable, the libtard way of saying going back to the Middle Ages. Live in a sustainable community. So you can walk everywhere. You don't need to drive a car.
Yeah.
That's what it'll be. It'll be like living in a village. I work. I fly out of Miami International Airport. That's where I'm based. If I had to live within walking distance, I mean, how many people want to live walking distance to a major international airport where planes are taking off and landing all day and night? Well, that's why I don't live right next to the airport. I found a community that I like to live in, and I drive to work when I have to go fly. They don't want us having those kinds of liberties and freedoms. They want us just staying in our little community and living in our little hovel and regressing back to the Middle Ages. So anytime you hear the word sustainable, be highly suspicious. So, but that was my take on algae today. Why are we trying to produce something that we already have in huge abundance? And I covered this last week, but when the president says we only have 2% of the oil reserves, it's 2% of the proven. Proven means there's a drill going, not a drill, but a pipe going down in there and we're pumping it out. We're actively pumping oil out. We know where there's all kinds of other oil in the U.S. and offshore and in Alaska and in the Gulf. We know where there's way more oil than 2% of the Earth's reserves. So that's not truthful at all when he says that. But I was just listening to the news a little bit earlier today, and you know when you hear the word social safety net, Democrats are saying that the Republicans' budget will destroy the social safety net. It's because in their budget they're trying to address some of the issues that will eventually hit us when it comes to Medicare and Social Security. So when libtards say social safety net, what they're saying is entitlements that we are not willing to reform. We're going to keep promising them, but we're not going to be able to pay for them. So eventually it'll come to an end. So that was what I got to thinking, Paula. What happens when it comes to an end? Either it comes to an end, what will the Democrats finally say, okay, let's talk about reforming some entitlements? The reason they never want to talk about it and refuse, or they'll talk about it but never actually do anything about it, is a very important reason. It's because they don't control everything yet. See, once you control everything, in other words, there are no more two parties, it's just, we destroy the Constitution, we don't have that rule of law, and we make up a new thing, as Obama said, we're going to fundamentally transform the United States of America, into some kind of a dictatorship or Marxist socialist country. Once you control everything, like the Soviet Union did, then you don't have to worry about getting reelected. You can talk all you want about the social safety net and how you're going to scale it back. You can lie, too. You can say, oh, no, we're not scaling. We're like, what's his name did? One of the premiers in the Soviet Union was constantly talking about how much a wheat production was up when there was no wheat production or very little of it. It was all lies to make the world think they were doing just fine when, in fact, millions and millions were starving. So you can say, oh, yeah, no problem. You're going to get your Medicare and you're going to get your Social Security and then not deliver, and then what do the people do? You don't have a democratic system anymore. So it's like Cuba. You can do whatever you want. So that's really what their goal is, and they've accelerated their goal to take control of everything, whether it be healthcare, the auto industry, other industries. Healthcare industry is a big industry to get control of. And once you have control of that, you control people's lives. And you can then ration out healthcare to save money on Medicare. And people can complain about it all they want, but they can't do anything about it because you don't live in a representative democracy anymore, where you don't have a republic with a representative democracy anymore. You can't do anything about it. So that's their goal. They've got to destroy the system, the government system we have today, so that they have total control. And then, oh, yeah, they'll reform social safety net real quickly. There will not be a social safety net, just like we read the communist or the Soviet constitution? Man, it was a massive social safety net, except it didn't actually exist, just on paper. And there's nothing that people could do about it. So, and when they promise you more than they can actually deliver, whether it be a place like California or Greece, it's got to come from somewhere. And when the majority of people are dependent on government, wholly dependent on government, and those that have been paying the bills and the taxes, the fat cats and the millionaires and billionaires, and that's not enough anymore, it'll start dipping on down into the middle class, and then it'll dip down into the lower economic demographics. And everybody will have to pay their fair share, but today the middle class and poor folks are paying their fair share. It's just the rich. But once we run out of money and can't fund Social Security and Medicare, then those will be on the chopping block, and all of you and I, our taxes will go up, and everybody below us and in between us, and that'll be the way it is because, sorry, we'll be the next Greece. I mean, that's what's going on in Greece. That's why all the rioting and fighting. Now, they're telling people, yeah, you're not going to get a pension now, and your taxes are going up, and on, and they're not liking that. They said, yeah, but you promised. Well, we promised more than we could deliver, and all in an effort to get elected and take control of the country and have absolute control, and it just never works out. Never works out. Anyway, I've got a couple things to talk about because we're kind of in the lying mode. Not that we're lying, but we're calling them out on their lies. And did you, Paula, happen to see that advertisement, campaign advertisement put together for Obama, narrated by Tom Hanks? I knew he was a libtard, but I didn't think he was that stupid. But in any case... Yeah, it's called something like the road we've been on or something like that.
Yeah,
did you hear about that or see that?
I'm just looking at it now. I wasn't aware that the thing was out there, but it's a 17-minute ad campaign directed by Oscar winner and narrated by Tom Hanks, and it's called The Road We've Traveled, and it charts the course of the president's first term to a dramatic soundtrack, and it portrays the president as a heroic figure locked in a solitary struggle with the world's greatest problems. Its narrative is built around breathless tributes from Vice President Joe Biden, former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, and other senior administration figures. Behind its glossy feel is the steady hand of Davis Guggenheim, who won an Oscar for An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's documentary on climate change. Longtime Obama supporter Guggenheim also shot a short biographical film for the then senator to use as he claimed the Democratic nomination in 2008. The Obama campaign released a 2-minute trailer on Thursday, and I wasn't aware of this, and will put out the full film to supporters in mid-March. The teasing trailer won few plaudits from Republicans. Quoting, unfortunately, Americans feel Obama's accomplishments each and every day after President Obama led our country to higher unemployment, record debt, and higher gas prices, unquote, a Republican spokeswoman told USA Today.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the guy who did the movie Inconvenient Truth, we've talked about that in the past, and it's full of lies. So it doesn't surprise me they'd go hire a really good liar to help them put together their film. He got an Oscar for lying. That was pretty impressive. Anyway, but I
Can we
took...
get paid for lying?
Yeah.
Can we get paid for lying?
Yeah, get paid for lying. Yeah, exactly. And then you can, sleep well at night, too, because you know you've done a great service to the world and the American public to let them know, that the truth really isn't the truth, but we're going to call it the truth. So I went to the fact checker, Glenn Kessler. He's good at this stuff. And sure enough, he had an article talking about this. And I'm going to read to you just a brief bit from this. It's probably from the trailer, but it focuses on Obama's mom getting cancer. And I'm going to also then talk about what he said back on the campaign trail in 2008 or 7, and then kind of piece it together to show you the overwhelming lie that they've put out here. And if you can't believe this stuff about his mom, what he says about his mother, then why would you believe anything else he says? Now, Jay Carney, White House spokesman, is saying that, well, look, this is his recollection. It's been called into question before, and yet they keep using it. So it's all trying to play on people's sympathy and give the justification for Obamacare. But we start off with Tom Hanks. He knew from experience the cost of waiting. And then we hear Obama say, when my mom got cancer, she wasn't a wealthy woman, and it pretty much drained all her resources. Then Michelle Obama chimes in. She developed ovarian cancer, never really had good, consistent insurance. That's a tough thing to deal with, watching your mother die of something that could have been prevented. I don't think he wants to see anyone go through that. Honestly, I don't think he cares. But back to Tom Hanks. And he remembered the millions of families like his who feel the pressure of rising costs and the fear of being denied or dropped from coverage. Now, as I read through that, Paula, did you hear me anywhere in there say health care insurance? No, Michelle Obama said consistent insurance. What kind of insurance? Car insurance? Homeowner's insurance? And then Tom Hanks used the word coverage, dropped from coverage. What coverage? Again, car care coverage, what? So in 2008, while campaigning, the president frequently suggested his mother had to fight with her health insurance company for treatment of her cancer because it considered her disease to be a pre-existing condition. In one of the presidential debates with John McCain, here's precisely what he said. For my mother to die of cancer at the age of 53 and have to spend the last months of her life in the hospital room arguing with insurance companies because they're saying that this may be a pre-existing condition and they don't have to pay her treatment, there's something fundamentally wrong about that. Now, you just heard what he said, that they wouldn't have to, it might be a pre-existing condition, and they wouldn't have to pay her treatment. Okay. But earlier this year, journalist Jannie Scott cast serious doubt on this version of events in her excellent biography, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Scott reviewed letters from Dunham, his mother, to Cigna Insurance Company and revealed the dispute was not over health insurance coverage. It was over disability coverage. Disability is what a company would pay you when you're out of work and can't earn money. And the dispute was based on her going to the hospital and the doctor saying he needs to run more tests on her because it looks like she might have a problem, could be cancer, but it could be, whatever. And her then getting hired by this company. The company that she got hired with, it doesn't say. I thought I copied that here. But in any case, let me just read to you what I have, the notes that I have here. Scott writes that Dunham, who died in 1995, had health insurance that covered most of the costs of her medical treatment. The hospital bill billed her insurance company directly, leaving Ann to pay only the deductible and any uncovered expenses. Now, let's see. Oh, yeah, here I do have that information. But she had filed a disability claim to help pay those additional expenses. The company denied the claim because her doctor had suspected uterine cancer during an office visit 2.5 months before she started her job with Development Alternatives. Though Dunham said the doctor had not discussed the possibility with her of cancer, but he did want to give her some additional tests. So here are some things that from what I read to you that was in that ad that we're now going to kind of wade through. Tom Hanks said the president knew the cost of waiting on reform. Reform of what? Healthcare bill is the reform of the healthcare industry, not the disability industry, not disability coverage. So that's a lie right there. But he didn't say healthcare reform because they know they can't say that because the story isn't actually what they're claiming. Second of all, president says cancer drained all her resources. Well, health insurance paid the vast majority of her bills, other than her copay or deductible or whatever else that she might have had to pay. So this is not a case of somebody being bankrupted by tens of thousands of dollars of health care bills. Her salary in 1995, the year that she died, was $82,500, which in today's dollars is about $123,000. So it's not like she hadn't been earning money and couldn't afford to pay for anything. Then Mrs. Obama says that in that little clip that Dunham never really had good, consistent insurance. Well, she didn't have a good, consistent job. And that's kind of what happened. So, yes, we should be looking to help people out. And come up with a way to cover people that can't have a good, consistent job or are out of work. But why does that mean taking the entire industry over and nationalizing it? Those are two different things. But she did have good health care coverage at the time. Now, the First Lady also suggests death could have been prevented. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. Before going overseas, Dunham was too busy with work and skipped an important test recommended by her U.S. doctor, dilation and curettage, that might have spotted the cancer earlier. Might have. She skipped the test. Now, once she got to Indonesia, she was not feeling so good a few months later. She went to a doctor, and he believed she had appendectomy, which, you know, she needed her appendix removed. So they removed her appendix. But by the time they eventually found out, and that didn't cure things, that she was getting sicker and sicker, and they discovered the cancer, it was third stage. So the First Lady suggests that it could have been prevented. Yeah, not by having health care insurance, because she had that. So it's all extremely deceptive. It's really a big lie. And then they're using their, you know, God rest her soul, late mother, to do all this. Finally, Tom Hanks says that Obama's family felt the pressure of rising costs and the fear of being denied or dropped from coverage. Well, not health care coverage. She had it. And why would she be denied if she had health care coverage? She wasn't. Even though the insurance company didn't want to pay her disability, they paid for the health care. And they didn't even argue about it. Okay, so it's all extremely deceptive. So that's our number one lie of the day. Did you see the article, Paula, about what really transpired and why that's coming out now? There may be a reason behind it, but what really transpired during the debt ceiling crisis, you know, issue last August? Do you see that article? It was out in the Washington Post.
No, I hadn't seen that.
It's a very long article, very long article. But I'm going to talk a little bit about this because Rush Limbaugh talked about it on his show yesterday. It's pretty interesting, and so I went and researched it. I read the article, and what he was saying was absolutely true. And this is the Washington Post, which Mark Levin always refers to as the Washington Compost. They're a pretty liberal newspaper, and for them to put this out there, it kind of makes you wonder what exactly is going on. But now, this is all according to what Rush Limbaugh said the other day, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the article itself. But in his show yesterday, he was talking about the fact that Obama purposely, intentionally lied to the American people when he told us that Republicans were not interested in raising taxes, that they wanted a cuts-only solution to the debt crisis. Mm-hmm. It turns out that John Boehner and Eric Cantor had indeed offered an $808 billion tax increase for the president. So he lied. He just flat out lied. They gave him. Now, you wonder, well, why didn't they come out afterwards and say, oh, no, the president's not telling the truth. We did offer him. No. It was all done behind doors, closed doors, and it was something that Boehner was going to have to sell to the Republican Congress and get them to go along with taxes because a lot of them made promises they wouldn't raise taxes when they were running for office. So that was going to be an issue, but it was all done with secret wheeling and dealing. For example, on that Sunday in July, Boehner seemed willing to hash out some kind of a deal, and so he met in private with the president and his aide many times. So their sessions were so sensitive, especially for the speaker, you know, with a conservative Republican House full of Tea Partiers and all such, that Obama's aides were under strict orders to protect Boehner and not talk about his private entreaties. Obama, like Boehner, they got along well during the private sessions. And you remember that's back when they went and played a round of golf?
Yep.
So that's what was going on behind the scenes. And that's why we didn't hear it. We knew kind of that was going on, but it definitely was going on. But here's where, you know, it gets starts to become more obvious about what happened and why. The secrecy would be essential as the details came together. The president told everybody that's how it had to be. He spoke openly with Boehner about how the two sides might sell the emerging plan to their respective parties. In other words, The president's got to sell the cuts that the Republicans wanted, and Boehner's going to have to sell the tax increases. He asked, how soon can it be drafted? The president asked. And this is according to notes that were taken during the meeting by a top Republican staff member that the Post got a hold of. When Obama left, the negotiators rushed to get going. Staffers on both sides now energized by the prospect of a deal. 3 days later, the grand bargain was dead. But interviews with most of the central players in those talks, some of whom were granted anonymity to speak about the secret negotiations with the Washington Post, as well as a review of meeting notes, emails, and the negotiating proposals that changed hands, offer a more complicated picture of the collapse. Obama ended up getting cold feet. He got nervous about how to defend the emerging agreement with his own Democrat base. So he upped the ante. They don't specify what he did, but he upped the ante. In other words, the Republicans were going to have to compromise even more. Maybe it was even higher taxes or some additional taxes. But Boehner knew there's no way I can sell that. So things sort of fell apart, but then the president tried at the last minute to put the original framework back in play, but it was too late by then. So then he comes out and says, it's the do-nothing Congress. And that's really what we're leading up to here. He's got to run on a do-nothing Congress. And, you know, it's Obama who needs the debt limit increase so he can continue to buy votes, expand government, and whatever else his plans are. What Boehner and the boys decided to do was essentially call his bluff. He was setting up to run against a do-nothing Congress. So they said, okay, here you go. We'll give you a deal and we'll raise taxes. He rejected it and then addressed the nation and lied, saying it was them who walked out and would not compromise. He's got to run on the do-nothing Congress because he's a do-nothing failure president. That's the only way he's going to get away with it, and he lied about it. From the New York Times on July 23rd, the title of this story was Debt Ceiling Cost Collapse as Boehner Walks Out. Then in August is when the country's debt ceiling had its credit rating downgraded, August of 2011. We lost our AAA credit rating because the debt ceiling fell through, and we now know, thanks to the Washington Post, that it fell through because Obama refused to accept it. It had everything in it he wanted, and that was the problem. His bluff had been called. I think, at the end of the negotiations, Boehner and the Republicans just decided, okay, let's see what happens, because it was proving impossible to negotiate with them. Every day they negotiated, Boehner and Cantor then on the news would hear that they're not agreeing to things or there are things going on that they didn't discuss or agree to or not agree to. That's what the president was doing, putting out lies every day as that went on. And then in the end, the big grand lie was, they wouldn't compromise, which is totally not true. And the only reason they didn't bring this up, because then people, a bunch of crybabies, that's probably not what really happened. You're just making that up. But the Washington Post brought this up. The Washington Post. So now it's out there that the president can't cut a deal, and even when he does get a deal, he can't take it because then it looks like he's able to cut deals, and he needs to run against a do-nothing Congress.
Right.
So the other thing that's a big lie, and we talked about this before, but that there's no silver bullet when it comes to gas prices, and it's not the president's fault. You know, when President Bush was president and gas prices got up to about $4 a gallon, he lifted presidential and congressional moratoriums on expanded drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf, a move that many people said he did too late. But remember where gas went from there? Down to $1.85. And libtards will tell you, oh, no, it's because of the bad economy and, people driving less. I actually saw somebody wrote an article. People driving less. Yeah, we are driving less, and the economy's bad, but the price of gas went down before that all really kind of came about. Yes, the economy was starting to go down and have problems, but people weren't cutting back on driving at that point. Look, people have still cut back on driving, but the price of gas is higher than it was back then. It was precisely by letting the world know we're going to suck more oil out of the ground. Boom, price of gas goes down. That's all you have to do. There is a silver bullet. So he's lying when he says there's no silver bullet. And he wants the price of gas to go up and up and up to force his whole green energy and everybody, turn your thermostat down to 50 degrees in the winter and up to 90 degrees in the summer. I mean, the guy's a nut job, I'm starting to think, because he's got these diluted ideas of what, how we want to live our lives, and people don't want that anymore. People are getting pretty tired of hearing this stuff and saying, you know what, you're just taking away more and more of my choices and liberty, and all for something that's unproven, and it just doesn't make sense, and it doesn't. He's got an agenda. Obama's a great theorist. You know, he's an academic. He doesn't know anything about the real world, and it's proven. And this is all pure incompetence on his part. I mean, it's deceptive. It might not be incompetence. It may just be that he knows what he's got to do to move forward and get reelected, and he'll compromise anybody and everybody in that process, which is what he's doing. So those were the articles. Let me see if there was one other thing that I wanted to bring up. I think that was kind of it. So I'm kind of done for the day, Paula, with what I think is some of the important news out there. Washington Post article exposing that the president is the one who backed out of a deal, and there was a deal, and that the Republicans did compromise. And his ad full of lies, and done by a guy who's known for being producing movies, documentaries that are full of lies. So there we go. We have the lying administration. Anything that you saw that caught your eye you wanted to talk about, Paula?
No, just, you know, a reiteration last evening being on Bella D'Angelo's show. We had with us Don Richards and Gina Diefenbach, Frank Day from EDL, and Frank Aquila she had on afterwards, who is author of Sarah Palin's book, Out of Nowhere. You know, just the things that we were talking about last night. And, you know, I have to tell you, she was very thankful to both of us, and more so you, Tom, because you were the one that put her on the path to internet radio, and she didn't think that she could do it, and, you know, this is a year later, and she's really happy where she is and what she's doing. You know, she has her own company, Isabella Oilfield Services. She is self-funded. There is a lot of work where she is, but it's, you know, getting the word out to tell people, you know, go out to North Dakota and, you know, make that small sacrifice and go out there and start something, start a new life, and getting the word out and telling people about what's going on in this country and to pay attention to the real issues, to the economy, to jobs, to healthcare, not the nonsensical BS that the media is putting out there and you know, trying to sway, you know, where we want to keep our minds.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's important, and she does a good show, gets a lot of good people on there, and I'm glad that she's got her own business now. The company I think she was working for before was okay, and she was doing all right, but I'm glad she's able. She's got her own business now. That means she can, you know, work the way she wants to work and do the show when she wants to do the show. So that's
it
great.
Is,
that's
but
awesome.
Again, she's self-funded, so it can be a little tricky at times. She doesn't have funding coming from an outside source. So
yeah,
well, you know, but she's persevering, and she's a woman in this country, in this economy, and she's, hey, I got to give it to her. You know, to her.
Yeah. Well, I got, just to bring up real quickly here, one thing that happened today, I believe, in the last couple of days, I guess. I got contacted by the Ozzie DeFaria for Congress campaign, and it looks like we'll be able to get him on the show. But Ozzie, he's a businessman, a successful businessman, and his parents, sort of like the whole Marco Rubio thing, came from Cape Verde Islands, a Portuguese colony.
Yeah,
DeFaria. Yeah, so anyway, we're going to get him on the show, and I've been kind of looking into, I want to know more about him. I'm going to try and meet him next week and his campaign manager. It sounds like they're doing okay, pretty good on fundraising, and they've got some experience, some folks that know what they're doing in terms of running a campaign, so they're not going to waste that money. They're going to, you know, use it well. But guess who he's running against in Florida? an incumbent Democrat.
My good friend, Debbie, what's her next line, Schultz?
You got it. Yeah. So
take the woman down.
Right. Now, we've got, there are a couple other candidates in the primary, the Republicans, that have been, you know, going after her for some time. Karen Harrington and Joe Kaufman, who are both, and I think we've had both of them on the show. I remember having Joe, and I think we had Karen come on the show for a while on one of the shows. That would have been months and months ago. But so it's only fair to have Ozzy on, but he sounds like a very interesting guy and an accomplished businessman. And, boy, he you know, has, I think, just on the surface looking at him, what it takes in terms of a resume to take her out. In terms of saying, here's who I am and what I've accomplished in life, and I am going to take those skills and experience and go to Congress to help our country, but also help this district here, which is important. So in any case, we can look forward to having Ozzy on the show in the next few weeks, and I'll make sure I put all that information on the website and Facebook. And if you're not following us on Facebook, you need to go to The American Hour Radio Show on Facebook. Do a search for that. You'll find all the information we like to put out of upcoming shows and how to listen to the show, links to the website. The website's usaradionetwork.com, but Facebook, we're able to put a lot more information out there about upcoming shows, and you can scroll back and look at past shows and that kind of thing. And if you go to that page and you've never been there, you really need to click on that like button. And then, Paula, we passed a milestone today. We have over 4,500 followers on Twitter. And if you're not on Twitter, yeah. So we're on our way to 5,000. We're getting
Yahoo!
There. But and anybody that's familiar with Twitter, look for The American Hour. If you're not familiar with Twitter, go check it out, because there's some great people on Twitter putting stuff out, and I follow some of those people, and sometimes I don't even have to look at the news to find out what's going on in the world, and it's nice and quick and concise, and so it can be fun, and it's different than Facebook. It's just what it is, but it's pretty cool. So check us out there on Twitter. Get an account if you don't have one, The American Hour. That's it, just The American Hour, all no spaces or anything. And let's see, what else? That's it for news for today. We'll be back tomorrow night. We'll talk about the Commerce Clause and dig into that a little bit without getting too dry and drawn out. But I will make the case clear as to why Obamacare is unconstitutional and why it is so dangerous to our future in this country, trying to use the Commerce Clause to do that, and how the Supreme Court has been violating the Constitution to get the Commerce Clause to where it is today. So we'll look at all of that tomorrow night. Paula, unless you have something else, you can take us out.
Hi, we're going to continue our series with Honoring the Fallen, where the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans this year, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Five names I'll be reading this evening are David Elliott Cabrera, 41, John Robert Wimpy Cable, 19, Sean Callahan, 23, Christopher Lebiano Camaro, 19, and Christopher George Campbell, 36. Off the Military Times website, I came across an article. Army Lieutenant Colonel David E. Cabrera lost his life on October 29, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was 41 years old of Abilene, Texas, and he was assigned to the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. Excuse me. He lost his life in Kabul Province, Afghanistan, of wounds caused by an improvised explosive device. Also killed were Army Staff Sergeant Christopher R. Newman, Army Sergeant James M. Darrow, and Army Sergeant Carlo F. Eugenio. A Taliban suicide bomber had rammed a vehicle loaded with explosives into an armored NATO bus on October 29th on a busy thoroughfare in Kabul, killing 17 people, including a dozen Americans, in the deadliest strike at that time against the U.S.-led coalition in the Afghan capital since the war had begun. The blast occurred on the same day that a man wearing an Afghan army uniform killed three Australian soldiers and an Afghan interpreter in the south, and attacks that show the resiliency of the insurgency are likely to raise new doubts about the unpopular 10-year-old war and the Western strategy of trying to talk peace with the Taliban. A spokesman for the fundamentalist Islamic movement, which was ousted in 2001 invasion for its affiliation with Al-Qaeda, claimed responsibility for the attack, saying the bomber had used 1,540 pounds of explosives. Excuse me. The Taliban and related groups have staged more than a dozen major attacks at that point in Kabul that year, including seven since June of 2011, in an apparent campaign to weaken confidence in the Afghan government as it prepared to take over its own security ahead of 2014 deadline for the U.S. and other NATO countries to withdraw their troops or move them into support roles. Underscoring the difficulties ahead, the brazen assault occurred hours after top Afghan and Western officials met in the heart of Kabul to discuss the second phase of shifting security responsibilities to Afghan forces in all or part of 17 of the country's 34 provinces. Afghans already had the lead in the Afghan capital. U.S. soldiers had wept as they pulled bodies from the debris. NATO said five of its service members and eight civilian contractors working for the coalition had died in the attack. The attack broke a relative lull in the Afghan capital, which had experienced a number of attacks in recent years that are often blamed on the Haqqani Network, which is an Al-Qaeda and Taliban-linked movement that operates out of Pakistan. The most recent attack at that point in Kabul was prior to that in September, the assassination of former Afghan President Rabbani by an insurgent who detonated a bomb hidden in his turban. The attacker was posting as a peace emissary coming to meet Rabbani, who was leading a government effort to broker the peace with the Taliban. I'd like our listeners to pay attention to what's going on and to listen as I read these things, because, you know, our sons and our brothers and our daughters and our sisters, they're all over there, and they're fighting for a cause that they believe in. And you know, to everyone that's serving over there, you know, specifically the Army, your families love and miss you dearly, and they love you very much. We all love you, and we thank you for the service that you're doing for our country and for the citizens of Afghanistan. We pray that you'll come home real soon.
Yes, I second that. Hear, hear. All right, Paula, thanks. I appreciate that. And that's all we got, folks. Thanks for joining us tonight. We will see you tomorrow night, 7 p.m., same place, and we'll talk some about the Constitution. Thanks, Paula. Have a great night.
You too.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.